Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. And Bruce, there are some signs that the season is not that far away anymore. We're seeing some kickoff times get announced and Vegas win totals are coming out. And we're going to play a little game in a few minutes where we go through some of those win totals and what we think about them. But first, your weekly Somebody Talks About NIL update.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into this, into it. Our friend Ross Dellinger, who does a terrific job at SI.com, had a sit down with Lane Kiffin from Ole Miss. And Lane Kiffin, who is almost always outspoken, and comes across on the NIL issue and the NIL issue collectives and all sorts of other things, I think very reasonable. Probably more so, he's more open to just kind of speak his mind than most coaches are. A lot of times coaches get tangled up in this issue. A lot of times even ADs, remember we had Bubba Cunningham on, I don't know how long ago it was, probably a year ago. And kind of like, do you remember that?
No, that was
2 years ago.
It was more than a year ago. It was before
it was
NIL.
Ago.
It was probably 2 years ago. And it was, I remember you and I got off the interview and looked at each other like, does he not realize that ship has sailed? He was playing the whole like amateurism and anyway, Lane, the way I would put it is he's a realist. And so where you see all these coaches like Jimbo and Saban, we got to do something about this. Everything's out of control. Is this really what we want college football to be? And Lane has just accepted that this is what college football is going to be. And you either adapt or you don't. We're professional sport, he says, and they are professional players. I've said from the beginning, players should get paid. They do the work. Why that should be limited to a scholarship check, I disagree with. And they shouldn't be paid all equal. That's not what happens in the real world. Why does their best player get paid the same as the worst player? That's not real life. Now, he talks about you're trying to do this with no salary cap and unrestricted free agency and so on and so forth. But he's saying it's basically the equivalent. If you're complaining about this here, I have to a lot of people will sit back and say, oh, it'll go away. NCAA will fix it. Okay, go ahead and wait. As a coach and AD, you won't be there. There will be a new coach and AD. It's here. I'm like others. How long is it here? How are they going to fix it? I don't care. It's here. I have to present to boosters to say, hey, this is what needs to be done. Resistance to it would be like still huddling and using an I formation offense. People tried to avoid it. We're not doing that crap. Almost all those people are out of jobs. It's kind of the adapt and die motto or die motto.
Yeah, look, I mean, as he says in the article, Nick Saban had to adapt scheme-wise on offense. He did. And I think it's one of these things where I think the more people try to kind of cling to an outdated model or a feeling of, I don't know if it's nostalgic, but it's always been this, you know, like even, you know, the guys who may not speak about it openly about Lane, they'll always talk like Leach would always talk about, like, just because it's been done a certain way for a long time doesn't mean it's the right way to do things, you know. And, you know, look, I give credit to Lane for just cutting through the BS. You know, I feel like a lot of his peers get tangled up in that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we're looking at a sea change because there's not easy answers to this. We're not going to, you know, you could have a salary cap, but that's not, people aren't going to hold to that. The same people who, many of the same people who are involved in collectives are boosters who would not respect the salary cap. They would find a way around that because they, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to try to do what's best for their beloved program, not for anything out of altruism.
There also can't be a salary cap unless you're actually going to go all the way in and say that the players are employees and you collectively bargain with them. You can't just, you know, he likes to throw that salary cap thing out there without necessarily going into all the steps and mechanisms that would have to take for it to get to that point. A couple observations in here. He said, you've got kids going to schools now, and some haven't even taken a visit. They signed because of the NILs. You got to think that is here to say. To say that's not sustainable, why? 10 years ago, no one would have said schools were going to pay coaches $10 million a year. Well, they do now. That's very similar to something he said when I was there in April, which is the schools always find the money. And so this notion that, and I hear it all the time, that, well, just wait until a few of these kids turn out to be busts. You know, the boosters won't do it again. That's not how the coaching market has ever worked. There's no correction. There's been never been a moment where people said, you know what, the salary's gotten a little too high. The buyouts are getting out of control. We're going to keep our money in our wallet. These boosters want to win so badly, and they'll spend whatever it takes. And so he says these same donors that pay $30 to $40 million to a coach just to fire him, but they're not going to raise $20 million a year for players. Yeah, they are. It just means they're not going to give it to other things like campus, like facilities. I think he's right.
You think they'd be less inclined to give the money to the coaching staff then? Coaching salaries have skyrocketed. I mean, is there an endless supply of money we're talking about now?
Well, for most schools, not all, the coaching salaries come from the TV revenue, right? And the TV revenue, as we know, is only going to go up and up and up and up. The whole flaw of the NIL model is that they've outsourced it, that the schools themselves can't be involved. So these third-party collectives have, you know, stepped up and taken their place. If the schools themselves were the ones buying the players' NIL rights and then you know, making deals for them, then you would get into the issue of, well, should we be spending more on the coaches or more on the players?
And, well, then you would also think you could manage it better, because also you can't feign ignorance like Jimbo Fisher is trying to do about, we don't know what our collectives are doing. We don't, you know, it says, wait a minute, they're just spending all this money for this random player. We don't know if he's any good. You know, come on, that's BS. We know that. And I also think there would be more of a direct line to what people are getting paid, because nobody really knows other than perhaps the agent who might have drawn up the contract, who might have done the shopping spree on this. And I think that there is so, because you said it's outsourced, it's been so out of control on that regard. And also what it's done is the people who are identified as boosters and declared as boosters by the NCAA, now they are in the process. They didn't want that. But now that's what's happened. You know, it's like probably the worst possible outcomes if you are Mark Emmert or somebody who claimed to have been in leadership, in quotes, at the NCAA, this is what they brought.
Yeah, and the reason it's and the fundamental reason it's the way that it is that we still consider pay for play to be taboo. And because it's considered such a awful, evil thing, then the schools would not want to take part in it themselves. And at some point, that stigma is going to have to go away. And Lane's kind of hinting at that here. Not hinting, he's flat out saying, let's just acknowledge it what it is. These guys are, you know, he doesn't say this exactly, but putting their bodies out on the line every week for a sport that generates billions of dollars in revenue, of course they should get paid. How the mechanism for how that works, though, is more complicated than some people think.
He also he also got into an issue that you and I have talked about recently, which is the how screwed up the locker room dynamic is. I mean, he basically comes out and talks about, you know, a quarterback going to Tennessee for $6 to $8 million a year, and how is that going to work when that kid is making a lot more than anybody is in the program? That kid hasn't done anything for the program at that point. You know, it's like, how do you manage all that? As coaches, I mean, it's going to be a really fascinating petri dish on this front, you know, how it plays out. I mean, you know, in this Q&A with Ross, he goes into, you know, depth about when you're not necessarily maybe playing the guys you want to play, you're playing the ones who are getting paid the most. I can remember a story I heard at the AFCA a long time ago, almost 20 years ago. It was on, let's see if I can do this without identifying the player. It was on what would have been a 5-star rated recruit on a really mediocre, at the time, Southwestern Conference school who ended up there. Didn't turn out to be a great player. And the new head coach who was there was planning on not, you know, it's going to have somebody else as the starting quarterback. And was basically told, hey, if that kid's not starting, there's going to be a press conference like Monday morning, and that kid's going to say everything your school did to get him or something like that. And I remember that story very vividly, where I was when I was told it and everything. And that's not too far from what we're talking about here, is like, this is who we spend a lot of money on. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah. In fact, he brings up the exact analogy from his time at the Raiders. Ross brings up, when you were the head coach of the Raiders, you and then owner Al Davis became embroiled in a public fight over the playing time of number one draft pick Jamarcus Russell. Do you see that starting to play out in college? How is that not going to be an issue? He says that the donor pays the money for the player and you're not playing them, and that same donor gets you hired and fired. That donor is now what? The owner. I've been there when the owner calls and says, we need to play this guy. And I say, no, we need to play this other guy. I'll tell you what happens. You get fired. You get fired on an overhead projector. What's going to happen when the lead donor calls and says to play this guy and do you not get fired? Isn't it amazing to think back to that? Like, Lane Kiffin got fired by an owner who was so put out by him that he like did a whole projector presentation in the press conference. He got fired by USC on a tarmac. He got fired by Nick Saban.
Let's remember this though. The Lane Kiffin who was talking to Ross and who's talked to us a lot over the last year isn't really the exact same version of Lane, of what he was at maturity wise, or how he decorum wise, how he handled things. It's not at USC, certainly not at Tennessee, and I'm sure not at Alabama. So
no, he's the rare coach who, and look, people, you know, your book with Ed Orgeron was supposed to be, that was a snapshot into what was supposed to be a guy who had completely, changed his reputation to the point where he won a national championship, but then within a year or two, he was fired.
But the difference is there, that was a guy who his life story really is about recovery and substance abuse. And so there's a formal, like, people can say, okay, he was still, you know, a hothead and had all these instincts. But the point, you know, like, I think it's a little different there when somebody's going through a 12 step and they're in meetings and they're going through it. It's not to say, you know, one's right, one's wrong. I'm just saying there is a formal process of recovery. I think what we're talking about, maybe in Lane's case, is a maturation. It's not to say he's a radically different person, or he doesn't still do some stuff that probably would really make some ADs or school presidents uncomfortable. I think just in terms of like his perspective is probably much more informed now than it was a dozen years ago.
Yeah, I mean, basically, pre-Alabama, pre-Saban car wash, I mean, I can remember he was A, hated by a lot of fans, and part of that was the idea that he was born on third base because of who his dad was, and he got all these glamorous jobs way too young. Post-Alabama, he wins two conference titles in 3 years at FAU. He takes Ole Miss to the Sugar Bowl. He's widely respected for the offense he runs, and so I don't get the sense that the public necessarily views him that way anymore. I'm not saying he's like a hero by any means, but they tend to enjoy what he does on social media. And so he can do an interview like this and be taken seriously, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's not like, oh, that's that clown Lane Kiffin sounding off. It's like, oh yeah, he makes some good points here. What do you say, Bruce? We start thinking about how the 2022 season is going to play out on the field. And, you know, this week we get there's this guy, Jimmy Shapiro, who does publicity for the sports books. We're always getting emails from him. Hey, you might be interested in these. And 9 times out of 10, I'm going to admit I ignore them. But one like this, courtesy of Bet Online, I'm all in. So this email we got has Vegas win totals for every Power 5 team in alphabetical order. And I thought of a little game. You ready for this?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm going to read the team in the win total, and then we both have a decision to make. We're either going to say over, under, or pass.
And this is for 12 games. It is not including bowl games or conference championships.
That's right. It's regular season games. But here's the caveat. You can't go more than two in a row saying pass. You can't do three in a row pass.
Okay, are we gonna do, is this everybody in Power Five?
It is.
Okay.
Okay. It's a little ambitious. We'll see how we do on time, but let's zip through it. What do you say?
All right.
I don't want your 2-minute explanations. I don't want you breaking down the schedule. Just gut reaction. Ready?
Okay.
Let's start with the Alabama Crimson Tide over under 10.5.
I will take the over.
I will take the over as well. I don't think they're going to lose a regular season game. And most they'll lose. In fact, that's a little surprising because how often do they only win 10 regular season games? Not very often. All right, I'm all over this one. Arizona Wildcats over under 2.5. I think the Arizona Wildcats will comfortably over 2.5. What about you?
I think they'll go over, but their non-conference schedule is not easy. At San Diego State, I know you didn't want to get on the schedule, Mississippi State, and then North Dakota State. Those are the three non-conference games.
They could easily lose all three of those.
They probably will be underdogs in all three. So,
by the way, over, though. So we're recording this on Wednesday morning. I believe most of the, if not all of the conference networks are releasing their kickoff times on Thursday, but CBS has came out today. And, you know, those first 2 weeks, they don't have an SEC game. So getting the 3:30 Eastern slot week one, these same Arizona Wildcats with their 2.5 over under win total at San Diego State.
Yeah.
I know Antonio Morales is fired up.
Having watched a depleted ASU Brady Hoke team or the San Diego State team in the conference championship game, I imagine they will look a lot better, even though they lost some really good players off last year's team.
They lost the punt god.
Well, they also lost one of the best D linemen in the country as well. And they lost a good offensive lineman. All right, Arizona State, the arch rival. It is 5.5. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm taking the under.
I'm taking the under, too. By the way, they do play at Oklahoma State there. The other two games are very winnable, but I'm not going with them. Arkansas, 7.5.
That's tricky. I'm going to say pass.
Come on. You can't go pass. Just come on.
No, that's why pass is built into the game. There's some teams you're just like, I would not bet one way or the other. I could see them going as high as 9-3. I could see them going 6-6. I do like KJ Jefferson a lot. I think he's very underrated, but they lost a bunch of guys off that defense. And they're one of those teams where transfer portal, it's hard to forecast because which of those guys are going to pan out, which aren't.
So I think I like their transfer portal. I think they upgraded with a bunch of studs on defense. I think Barry Odom does a really good job there. You know, also lost a bunch of guys, Cincinnati. That is their first opponent. Their non-conference isn't easy with Cincinnati and at BYU. I will take the hunch and say they will win more than 7.5.
I like it. I like it. What about Auburn? 5.5. That seems... When's the last time Auburn went into a season projected or win total is not making a bowl?
Yeah. I mean, Fortuna and I did a story this week about like looking at situations where there could be coaching turnover and just, you know, where... And to me, Auburn's seat is really warm and... Oof, you know, 5.5 will not get it done. That's a low number. That is a low number when you have Mercer, San Jose State, and Western Kentucky on the schedule. There's also Penn State, but man, I want to be pushed on that because I think they have three sure wins, almost sure wins in the non-conference. But I don't know where they get the other three because, you know, Missouri is home. I'm going to say under.
I could see that. I could see them finishing dead last in the SEC West. I could. But like you said, if you're giving them three gimmies, then all they got to do is go 3-5 in the SEC. I'm going to pass. I'm going to take my two passes in a row there.
How about you only get three passes for the whole thing? You've already used two.
Whoa, you're changing the rules on me pretty quick.
I didn't change. I'm just like, are you doing pass on these? Come on, it's a podcast where no one's, you know, betting the house. Just.
All right, we're done with pass. Pass is gone. I'll go over on Arkansas, and I will go under on Auburn.
Okay. The Baylor Bears.
By the way, there's no way these numbers add up. No, we are not claiming that. Yeah. Somebody will go and afterward and total it up and be like, you know, it's mathematically impossible. We know. We're not trying that. Baylor, I'm taking the over. 8.5 over. I think that people assume they're just going to fall back to earth. but I've got a lot of faith in Dave Aranda, and you know, some people, I thought it was interesting that the guy who was their starting quarterback for most of a very good season last year wasn't able to win the job. I think that's probably a good sign for their offense.
I'm tempted to say under on this. I mean, like, the fall back to earth part, they were horrible his first year. They were terrific his second year. There's like no middle. I think this may be the middle. I think they may go 8-4. And that's not a bad year.
Okay. That's not a bad year at all. Boston I'll be College. Interested to see if you think Baylor is going to go 8-4. Then as we go through this, I'm going to be very interested to see who in the Big 12 you actually think is going to be better than that. All right. Boston College, 6.5. Phil Jurkovec back. That is a name I've messed up throughout his college career. Phil Jurkovec's back, 6.5.
Give me the over. I'm taking the over.
The ACC is a complete mess, but I'm taking the over.
All right. We are in agreement. The Cal Bears. Do I get to say your Cal Bears? 5.5?
I mean, I went to a concert in Berkeley recently, but I don't know that they're my Cal Bears. 5.5, huh? Gosh. Justin Wilcox has had them a little bit better than that for the most part over the past several years. They had a game canceled because of COVID last year. They had to play Arizona. Remember last year they had a COVID outbreak and they had to play Arizona with nobody and they lost that game.
I remember Washington.
Give me the over. I think he gets them to at least 6-6.
Even though they have to go to Notre Dame, I will agree with you. I will give them, I think he's got a good coaching staff. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Clemson, 10.5.
This is a fascinating one. It's basically a bet on whether you think Clemson goes back to being Clemson or last year was a sign of trouble. I think last year was a sign of trouble. I'm taking the under.
I'm going to agree with you, Sue. I don't think they're going to fall apart, but I think they may go, you know, win 9 or 10. I am going to agree.
I mean, they go 10-2, and it's a perfectly good season, but it's under.
You got a new defensive coordinator. I think Brent Venables was a huge piece there. I'm not saying they're going to fall apart, but to expect them to win more than 10.5, I'm going to say under.
By the way, the ACC, the oft-maligned ACC, I actually think is going to be pretty good this year because of the quarterbacks that are coming back, like Devin Leary, like Sam Hartman.
Tyler Van Dyke.
I don't know. Tyler Van Dyke. Brennan Armstrong.
Yeah.
Like it could actually be a pretty good conference this year, so it won't be easy for Clemson like it was some years.
I feel like Brennan Armstrong might be the most underrated quarterback in the country. I just don't feel
I
like
agree with you. In fact, I wrote about him in my mailbag this week. His stats last year were bonkers, and I remember watching the BYU game. Did you get to see that one? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
It was an absolute shootout. Nobody could stop anybody. It was 49-49 going into the fourth quarter, and then Brennan Armstrong got hurt, and they didn't score again, and BYU ran away from them. But
how long have we been doing the podcast, by the way? 6 years?
Since 2014.
So about 8 years. I suspect.
Is this the first time we've ever talked about Virginia?
No, but I think this is the first time I've ever heard you use the word bonkers on the podcast. Really? Or in real life. Oh, yeah.
I do use that word in my real life, though. So interesting. All right. Back to depressing Pac-12 teams. Colorado Buffs over under 3.5. I'm just pulling up their schedule to see if I can find
I'm taking the under.
Oh, I didn't realize they play at Minnesota, the return of Mike Sanford.
Ooh, a little bit.
Their non-conference is TCU at Air Force at Minnesota.
You're going with me. You're going at under 3.5.
I'm going under 3.5. Yeah. They lost pretty much, you name the key player, they lost to the transfer portal and didn't really.
Carl Durrell didn't really seem to make an effort to replace them.
Yeah.
Yeah. They lost some good defensive players to the NFL as well. Duke also 3.5.
I'd be lying if I said I know anything about who Duke has coming back.
You know, they don't have coming back is David Cutcliffe. Mike Elko's defense is now there.
What do you think?
So I cheated and I looked at their, you know, their first four games, your alma mater's in there. NCANT is in there. New coaching staff at Temple is in there, you know, at KU. I mean, I want to
wait. You're right. They could reach the over in their non-conference
before October. Yeah. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, new coaching staff, and I'm going to say, you know, because they play at Georgia Tech, not that late. You know, they have a chance, a real chance to be 4-2. So I'm going to say over.
I'm going to say they beat Temple and Northwestern and North Carolina AT&T. I think they lose at Kansas because I actually think Kansas is this could be their year. It gets pretty rough after that. I'm going to say under.
Okay.
3-9.
Okay. Florida Gators, low number, 6.5. I'm curious how, like, when they've been this low.
Sometime in the Will Muschamp era?
Maybe. I don't know.
You know, they open with Utah. This is one of those teams. There's a lot of teams this year, especially ones with new coaches, that I think are just impossible to predict. And that's one of them. But I'd like to think they could get to 7-5, so I'll take the over.
Yeah, I know. They have Eastern Washington there. They have obviously they play Vandy. Oof, at South Florida. 6.5 is a low number. I mean, their quarterback's really talented. I think Billy Napier put together a very nice staff. I'm going to go over.
Okay, here's another interesting one. Florida State, 6.5. I tell you what, if he doesn't hit that, he's not going to be the coach next year.
No, I that's my instinct, too. You can't miss the, you know, again. By the way, they have a super interesting week, too, which, you know, we can talk about maybe in a minute. But, like, LSU, that's one of the, you know, ABC primetime games. I don't know. Like, I mean,
this is when I would have said pass if you would let me pass.
Yeah.
I'm going to say over. I'm going to say they get to 7 wins. I read Chris Fanini's state of the program on Florida State recently. It was brimming with optimism.
You know what, though? Like, this would be the example of when you just said a minute ago how, like, what we pick doesn't add up. I'm looking at Florida at the bottom. That could be the decider to see who gets the 7 wins and who doesn't.
Yeah, no, that's true. Well, probably not both. So you're saying probably not both of them get the 7 wins.
Yeah. I, for whatever reason, and this is maybe because I have a little more confidence in the ability of the quarterback, but I almost have a little more confidence in Florida getting to 7 wins than I do in Florida State, even though Florida is in the tougher conference. I'm gonna cheat and say I think they go over, but I don't think both teams are gonna go more. You know, one of these teams I think is not going to get past 6 wins.
Well, look, Florida State hasn't been to a bowl in 4 years. Like they. You know,
no, they were in a bowl like at one of Taggart's last year.
Sorry, 4 straight losing seasons is the stat. You're right. I don't think both of them are going to get the 7 wins.
Because you and I also did this with BC also.
So I'm going to go Florida over, Florida State under.
Like, I want to cheat and just say, yeah, I'll give them the over, but. I don't know. I'm gonna say under on this.
The defending national champion Georgia Bulldogs are at 10.5. Probably still the runaway favorite in the SEC East, but they did lose almost the entire starting lineup of that amazing defense last year. Guess what?
They're not the most talented defensive player on the whole unit.
Nope, Jalen Carter. I think they are going to lose 2 regular season games under Georgia.
Stu, are you picking Dan Lanning to beat his old boss and out of the gate?
Not necessarily.
Well, here's why I ask you that, Stu. If you look at the way their schedule sets up, and I did, I don't think there's another team. Like, Oregon, to me, is the closest team on their regular season schedule to saying, yeah, that's going to be a top 10 team.
Okay, so here you're making the fundamental mistake of preseason predictions, and everybody does this, and it drives me crazy. Everybody looks at the schedule and goes, they're better than these 11 teams, so they're going to win those games, and they're worse than the. There are upsets in college football. Teams lose to teams you have no earthly clue they're going to lose to because they're not, you know, the Green Bay Packers. So I'm saying, I don't know who that second loss will be to, but It's going to happen.
Go on the limb. Go say Sean Lewis and Kent State are knocking them off after you know, the South Carolina-Missouri road double. You're saying that's going to happen?
Remember yeah. one of the Jake Fromm years? They were a real, really good team. I think they finished in the top five, and they lost to a South Carolina team. That like these things happen. I could see that's actually a great upset trap. Week three at South Carolina, if Spencer Rattler turns out to be, you know, close to my the upset, old version of him.
The one upset, and I'm not sure how big of an upset it would be, is at Kentucky with Will Levis.
Yep.
Or what do we got to do now?
No, I think we're fine if we're still recording.
Oh, it just said we're recording. All right, I'm going to go over. I just don't think they're going to get knocked off twice.
Okay, fair enough.
Because I think it would be a big upset. I don't think anybody on the outside of Oregon, I don't even know what that spread is, would be within a 2-touchdown opponent. So I don't think they're going to lose double-digit underdogs twice.
All right, the Illinois Fighting Illini, year two, Brett Bielema, over under 4.5.
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking pass.
No.
I'm thinking that's actually going to be kind of a tough division this year with Iowa. I think Iowa's going to be pretty good again. Wisconsin, Minnesota. Purdue won 9 games last year, so I'm going to say under.
I'm going to say over.
Okay.
They got Chattanooga. They got Wyoming. I'm not sure how good Indiana's going to be this year. Your alma mater sitting there. That's 4. I think they're going to be physical enough to get another win. I think they'll at least get to 5.
Indiana Hoosiers, 4.5. Wow. They opened at 8 last year. And then they went, they were 4-8 last year?
No, they went like 2-10.
2-10 last year. You're right. Yeah. Oof. Yeah, I'm going to have to go under. I think that 20, great 2020 season turned out to be a aberration, not a trend.
Yeah, I'm going to go under as well.
This number seems strangely low. Iowa, 7.5. I think that's them saying they got really lucky to get to 10 wins last year. They had a, you know, insane amount of interceptions. But I gotta go over. Like, they're going to be really good on defense again. And, I mean, it would be a bad year for them if they only went 7-5.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. I just don't think – I still think they're on the upper level talent-wise. They're well-coached on both sides of the ball, especially on defense. They play complementary football. I think they can get to 8 wins.
Iowa State, 6.5. Opened at 9.5 last year. Not a lot of faith in Matt Campbell here.
A lot of good players to replace. Mm-hmm. I will take the over. I think that a lot of breaks, bounces went against them last year. I think it will switch. I still think they're one of the best coach teams in the country. I will give them, certainly get to 7 wins.
You know how with Florida and Florida State, we said they can't both be the over? In this one, I think they can't both be the under because somebody's going to win the Iowa-Iowa State game, and it's probably going to be Iowa. But Iowa State plays Southeast Missouri, Ohio, who was absolutely terrible last year. I'm going to go over because I feel like last year was the rare year where the expectations were high and they couldn't live up to it. Now the expectations will be low, so they'll overachieve. Here's my lock of the whole thing, Bruce. The Kansas Jayhawks will definitely go over 2.5 and, in fact, get closer to 5-7 than 2.
Yeah, they do have a tough, not one tough non-conference game at Houston, but I'm going to agree with you. I think Lance Leipold's such an upgrade compared to where they were before. I agree. I think they can get to 4 wins at least. K-State, 6.5.
Everybody's always overlooking K-State and Chris Klieman over 6.5, even though I remain very skeptical of Adrian Martinez.
All right, I'm going to go over as well.
Well, that was
Kentucky's 7.5.
Over on Kentucky 7.5. I think they finished second in the SEC East.
Okay, I'm going to go over as well. The Louisville Cardinals 5.5.
Now I feel like I'm starting to do too many overs. That they not all these teams can win all these games, but you know, I think Louisville's a bowl team.
I do too. LSU same price as Florida 6.5.
Woof.
LSU, by the way, is going to have as talented a defensive line as anybody in the country. I know that they have work on the O-line, but their defensive line is as talented as anybody. That's a good piece to have for Brian Kelly.
I'm just scrolling ahead to make sure there's some SEC teams that I would say under, so I don't say over for all of them. I'll have Brian Kelly getting the 7-5.
I will too. If you look at what they have, Florida State opener, Southern, that's a win. New Mexico, that's certainly a win. UAB, they should beat them. That's four. Neither one of us think Auburn is particularly good. I mean, that's five. I mean, now we're talking about getting a couple other wins. I think they get to seven wins. I think they get to seven.
Maryland Terrapins, 5.5. They feel like they've been knocking on the door. They haven't quite...
Well, they went to a bowl game last year. Yeah. This is not asking a ton.
It does seem a little low, other than obviously the division they play in.
Yeah, I mean, look, they have a talented quarterback with some really good receivers. The question has been their defense has not been very good.
Little bit of a tricky non-conference, or deceiving non-conference, I would say, Bruce. They open with Buffalo. I don't think they'll lose to Buffalo. Then they play at Charlotte, who they should beat, but has upset Power 5 teams before. And then SMU, no slouch there. I'm going to go under. I don't like the makings of this schedule. They play Purdue as a crossover game. They play at Wisconsin, in addition to, obviously, the Big Ten East Murderers Row. So I'll say under.
Okay, so here's how they should win the first two. I wouldn't worry about Buffalo or Charlotte much. SMU, I feel like I think you said, it's a toss-up. Then you're talking about Purdue at home, at Indiana, home Northwestern, Rutgers. Question is, I'm going to agree with you. I feel like it may be a 5-7.
All right, here's what we're going to do. We still want to get to some email questions. So what we're going to do is one more team, and then... And because we're in the M's, it's about halfway. So we're going to do one more team. And then part two, where we do the rest of the M's through Z's, although there are no Z's, we will do next week. And the last one is your alma mater, the Miami Hurricanes, Mario Cristobal, Tyler Van Dyke, over under 8.5.
I think they should be able to get to that. Their non-conference schedule, very, very manageable. Bethune-Cookman, Southern Miss, at Texas A&M, which will not be easy, and then Middle Tennessee. At worst, they should be 3-1. And then I'm looking at, all right, North Carolina. I think they're right now more talented than them. Virginia Tech rebuild, Duke, Florida State, Georgia Tech. I mean, right now, I would say maybe there's two teams in the ACC that would be more talented than them. One is Clemson. That's a road game. I mean, they don't play NC State here, who I think is after Clemson, probably the next best team. I think they should be able to get to 9 wins.
It does seem like, so we're talking about this when I said the ACC should be pretty good. It's more the ACC Atlantic should be pretty good. The Coastal still seems pretty light. With UNC,
I mean, Miami will have the best quarterback. You know, Brennan Armstrong is good. Tyler Van Dyke should be the best quarterback in pretty much every game they play.
I'm still going to take the under. I do think Mario Cristobal will do big things there, but 8-4 to me feels about right for his first season, especially one where they're playing at Texas A&M. I do like Tyler Van Dyke, but I think you're in a bit of a rebuilding situation still. So to think they're going to go 9-3 or better, yeah.
So you think they go 5-3 in the ACC?
Something like that. So under 8.5 on Miami, you're over, and we will leave the Michigan Wolverines to lead off the charge for next week's episode. What do you say we get to some emails?
Okay, as always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com.
The first question is something I've been hearing a lot of recently, but it's not an easy answer, right?
It's from Josh in Omaha. In recent months, Jack Swarbrick, that is the Notre Dame AD, has talked about the, quote, inevitable split at the D1 level. Gene Smith has floated an idea of 100-plus FBS programs splitting off under the umbrella of the CFP, and now the SEC is kicking the can on staging their own playoff. Where is this all going? It seems like too big of a coincidence for so many powerful people in the sport to speak on the record and ideas like this. Is a split coming sooner than any of us realized?
It's probably the fact that, no, it's not a coincidence they're all saying this, because they're all acknowledging that the system as we have is broken and there's got to be a better way. And in the NIL era is only accentuating the fact that some programs have a lot more money than others. The thing is, the one I don't get is the Gene Smith one. You know, he kept saying like, oh, some of these schools don't have much in common with the others. What does Ohio State have in common with most of those group of five teams? Like, what would be accomplished by 131 FBS programs splitting off? To me, that still seems extremely unwieldy. And you're still talking about schools that have absolutely nothing in common with the others. The interesting thing about Jack Swarbrick's comments, I thought, was the acknowledgement, and I think it's accurate, that the future of college football is two, I forget what he said exactly, solar system. The SEC and the Big Ten are kind of the two free-floating enterprises, and then everybody else is going to be, you know, kind of jumping. Everybody else is going to be trying to tag along with them in some form or fashion. And the SEC kicking the can on staging their own playoff is an example of that. I don't know if that's going to happen. It seems unlikely, but it's Greg Sankey flexing his muscle and saying, who's, by the way, extremely ticked off at the way those playoff expansion talks went down, saying, hey, what if we just do our own thing? We are the best conference. We produce the national champions. So maybe we should just go off and do this on our own.
Do you put any stock in my theory that Greg Sankey also decided, ooh, we got some ugly publicity in my conference with my biggest coach in Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher, and it has been the story of the sport. I need to pivot this as quickly as possible, and this is a good way to do it.
I believe you're right. You know, these meetings in Destin next week were already going to be pretty significant for the SEC, because they're going to be talking in particular about this future scheduling model for when they go to 16 teams. You know, I think it's down to, they go to 9 games, 6, and we don't need to get into the details of that. The point is, that's where he wants the focus to be, not on coaches taking jabs at each other.
Those aren't jabs, too. Those are payments.
Exactly right. The answer is, I don't know where this is all headed, but it's heading towards something different than the way we've always done it. I've said many times, I think ultimately where you're headed is the Ohio States and Alabamas and Georgias, regardless of conference, split off and do their own thing in football, because they are, you know, money cash cows that are playing a different. Ohio State is playing a different sport than Purdue. It just is. So it makes more sense for them to be aligned in football and football only with Alabama than with most of the teams in the Big Ten. But I don't know that that's going to happen in the next 5 years, or maybe even the next 10 years.
I don't disagree with you.
Craig in Detroit. Hey guys, love the show. A break from NIL, Saban, and Jimbo. I'm reading Bruce's crystal ball on the 2022 hot seat, and I can't figure out what Jeff Collins has done wrong at Georgia Tech. He has a strong coaching pedigree. He's seemingly done a nice job with Atlanta coaches with his 404 branding, but no results. Can he turn it around? What does success look like in year four?
I mean, they have not won more than 3 games in 3 years. A couple of things. First of all, it is a hard transition to make to go from the offense they ran there with Paul Johnson to something a little more traditional. I think what has made it harder, too, is you're talking about two of those 3 years have been in a pandemic. That is not easy. And then I talked to a coach in the league about this, who made the point, well, everyone's assuming that it's going to be so much easier to flip a program in the days of the portal. And he said, in actuality, it could be the opposite, because he had one great player in the program, Jamar Gibbs, and that guy left to go to Alabama. It's like, that's the hardest thing. When your franchise, the player up and leaves because he gets a better opportunity and he doesn't want to be patient anymore, that's a tough pill to swallow. Now, Jeff Collins is going to take over the defense. He brought in Chip Long to see if he can help the offense. I mean, they have to. I think if Jeff Collins gets the 5 wins, I think if you're Georgia Tech, I think you have to be like, okay, that's a positive season. He cannot afford another 3-win season. He has to show, you know, signs of life that, hey, we're taking a step and we're building here. I mean, it's year 4. I don't think if he goes 4-8, I think that would be tough for Georgia Tech, because I think a lot of people look at that with the recruiting base and what you have to sell there as this is a good job. I know a lot of coaches have been very intrigued by this, but you got to show them something, because all this, you know, the sizzle with Jeff, I think if you can get just some substance to go with it, that, hey, we have signs that we are building, as opposed to, yeah, the 2 best players in the program, one of them went to the NFL, the other one went to Alabama. That's a tough message to sell to a fan base that you're on the right track.
Bruce, it's been well documented on here that you and I could not have more opposite tastes in music. Do you know the band Cinderella?
I do not.
I wouldn't think you would. They were peak 80s hair metal band, but they had a power ballad, because all those bands had power ballads. A hit power ballad called "Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone." Remember all those years when Georgia Tech fans complained that Paul Johnson's teams were so boring and future NFL players don't want to come play in the triple option? Paul Johnson had a 9-4, 10-3 season, an 11-3 season. They went to a bowl game in all but 2 of his seasons. Like, how much would you want to go back to that right now after these 3-win seasons under Jeff Collins? But I think you're right that, you know, for all the great marketing he did when he first got there, it was always going to be a huge challenge to reinvent, to take a program that ran the triple option for all those years and turn it into a more modern program. Jeff Sims, as a freshman, I thought showed potential as a quarterback, but that did not pay off last year. You'd not see big improvement. So that coach is right. I think it's going to be easier for the LSUs and the USCs to flip the roster very quickly. I think it's going to be a lot harder for a Georgia Tech, who may be, you know, if they're struggling like they are, can inadvertently become a feeder system to the Alabamas of the world. So I'm not feeling very optimistic, but it might have been one of those cases where whoever succeeded Paul Johnson was going to have a rough time, and that you actually want to be the coach after the coach.
2 things that have come up here. One, I'm wondering if you've ever used the word bonkers on this podcast. And 2, you made me go on Wikipedia of Cinderella in parentheses band. Glam rock. I didn't see you as a glam rock guy.
But. Glam rock, I think that's not the accurate. I mean, there's, you know, some of these genres can blur together. But no, they were heavy. They were hair metal.
Who is glam? What is glam rock to you?
I have no idea. I've never really seen that phrase.
Who on the athletic staff would you most think of would be a glam rock fan?
Is glam, so glam rock, I'm trying to see who that, David Bowie is glam rock. No question. Queen was glam rock. Alice Cooper was glam rock. Like these bands or musical acts who their appearance was as big a deal as their music. Cinderella I'm hesitant to do that just because they were so good. No, Queen was really good too. Wait, though.
And David Bowie stunk.
All these bands were good. I don't know. It's like when they talk about who's punk and who's not. It's just in the eye of the beholder. But I group Cinderella with the genre, the period and genre that had like Quiet Riot, Motley Crue, eventually Guns N' Roses. Like they were part of that group. Warrant, okay. Poison.
Okay. Yeah. Let's pivot from Warrant and Poison to Jim Harbaugh. This is from Brian Johannes in Gilbert, Arizona. Thank you, Brian, by the way, for giving us the pronunciation, because I think we probably would have both screwed it up. Gentlemen, after Jim Harbaugh built Stanford up, David Shaw was not only able to continue the momentum, but take Stanford to the next level. However, the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen the Cardinal really dip down with 4-8 record in 2019, then 3-9 in 2021. Is it just a couple of bad years, or has Stanford run its course? And if so, what happened? Stu, you are the authority on this. You wrote our State of the Program at The Athletic probably a month ago. and did a deep dive into how Stanford has completely fallen apart.
Yeah.
Explain it.
Well, several reasons. All of the changes in college football that have happened over the last few years are kind of stacked against a school like Stanford. So when the early signing period began, because they're one of the rare schools where you have to be accepted into the school before they can offer you a scholarship, that worked against them. They didn't.
But that happened a long time ago.
Yeah, but I think it explains, you know, why 2 to 3 years after the fact, they suddenly declined. David Shaw told me that and by the way, just as big a part of that, not more so, was early enrollees. Stanford did not allow, the university did not allow early enrollees until last year. So this thing that is, you know, the norm for most of college
football. Why? But that's not that was my kind of point. That's something that has been around in college football for quite some time now.
Not for them.
They had good teams. I know, but I'm saying.
He was saying that once early signing period became a thing, then there became this expectation among the players that they recruit that they should be able to enroll early. And he basically said, like, you take whatever pool of recruits they can actually recruit in the first place and slice a third off that, because they weren't going to go anywhere where they couldn't early enroll. So the school is finally starting to adapt to that. Transfer portal. Stanford can't get transfers. You know, you want to transfer into Stanford as an undergraduate, you better start that process like a year ahead of time. They've had a few grad transfers, but they've lost plenty of transfers. So all that stuff's working against them. That being said, let's call it as it is. David Shaw has accomplished, he's the winningest coach in the history of the school. He's also a very stubborn coach, and he has made zero staff changes they were terrible last year, their defense in particular. Terrible. Same exact staff coming back this year. And I'm not somebody who I get what when he says, hey, I'm the son of a coach. A lot of times people fire assistant coaches just to scapegoat somebody. That's I get that. At the same time, I'm a believer that if things grow stagnant, you would really benefit from having some new voices in the room who can bring some of the experiences that they've had at other programs and help modernize your program. And he just hasn't done that. So I would say, have they run their course? Not necessarily, but I don't see a lot of obvious reasons for optimism.
Yeah, it's been interesting because there was a time where I was thinking, again, we'd look at things through the prism now of parents as opposed to of, you know, 17-year-old recruits, but where you'd be like, man, if you're a high academic college football prospect, why would you not seriously consider Stanford, given the opportunity and everything else and what an advantage it is? And it's in, you know, it's in a very desirable place. It's not like going to be shoveling snow all the time. Like, I could get why Stanford can be a more appealing than a Notre Dame, you know, lifestyle situation could be from a climate perspective, from a bunch of reasons. But at the same time, man, this program has lost almost all of its momentum. And you wonder, like when Jim Harbaugh was there, they had such an identity, right? I mean, they were a physical team that would brutalize you. And I know in your state of the program, that was one of the coaches that talked about that the people were wary of playing Stanford because they would pound you. Nobody's worried about them anymore. Say whatever you want about like how, what early enrollees and all that, just very different now, the feeling about Stanford.
Yeah. I mean, for all the, you know, acclaim and rightfully so for, Andrew Luck, Christian McCaffrey, Bryce Love, like these great skill players, it always started with the offensive line. And they, for whatever reason, this group that they recruited in 2019, that's basically, you know, been starters for 3 or 4 years, has just never really panned out. And without that, like, they can't run the ball. They, you know, this program that used to be known for that can't run the ball. They can't stop the run. They did get a really good recruiting class this past year, number 19 in the country, and has a bunch of highly ranked defensive linemen. So they're hoping that will help. And also Tanner McKee, I see all these early mock drafts. He's considered a late first round quarterback. So, you know, they do have him. I just don't know that they have, I don't see why the defense would suddenly get a lot better. We will close with this. I actually wrote about this topic too in the mailbag. Hi, Bruce and Stu. Great show. Can you take a tour around the conferences with respect to current and future TV deals? Who will be the winners and the losers? I know who one big winner is going to be.
I know who two big winners are going to be.
Well, the SEC is already a big winner because they already got their huge deal. And the Big Ten's about to cash in a big, big way.
I'm going to let you do this because I work at Fox and we have deals with the Big 12, the Big 10.
Okay, yeah. Conflict of interest. I get it. Well, and I kind of wrote about this. Everybody's waiting to see what happens with the Big 10. Kevin Warren at some point had suggested the deal might get done by right now, by Memorial Day weekend. I'm not hearing any inklings of that, but it should be soon. And so whatever happens, whoever gets left out of the next Big 10 deal, and by the way, I think it'll be ESPN, that has a ripple effect in terms of who will be the bidders for the Pac-12, which comes up in 2024, and the Big 12, which comes up in 2025. I think that those conferences will do okay just because there's always going to be a premium for live rights, and college football is a huge, hugely popular sport. But if there are people in the Pac-12 who think they're going to catch up to or come close to catching up to the Big Ten and the SEC, not happening. They just don't, every year I look at like the list of the highest rated games of the season, and they're always, it's like 18 of the 20 involve Big Ten or SEC teams. And then with the Big 12 losing Oklahoma and Texas, there are people who are feeling optimistic that they will at least stay where they are now. And there's people who think they will see a huge drop off. So I expect the Big 12 to be a loser. I expect the Pac-12 to be kind of like neutral. Like they'll do pretty well. They'll do a lot better than what they have now, but it won't be anything close to what the Big Ten and the SEC are getting. And then the true loser in all this is the ACC, who made their deal with ESPN. They were so desperate to get the ACC network, they made a deal and locked themselves into this deal for 20 years, and with no way to get out of it or renegotiate it. And if they can't find a way to do that, they're just going to sink farther and farther and farther and farther behind their competitors.
All right. Well, as always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We will have the second half of our over-under dialogue next week's episode. We'll see you next time.